Welcome to a special hour of KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, in for Gina Kaufman. Climate change was a topic that engaged young and old alike in 2019. It turned teenage environmental activist Greta Thunberg into an international celebrity. She was Time's Person of the Year. In this election year, we're likely to hear even more. Just witness that last Democratic presidential debate on CNN.
Unless we lead the world right now, not easy stuff, the planet we are leaving our kids will be uninhabitable and unhealthy.
This is no longer theoretical. And this is no longer off in the future. We have got to act, yes, to adapt.
I'm still shocked that I'm the only person on this stage who will say this. I would declare a state of emergency on day one on climate.
Climate change threatens every living thing on this planet, and the urgency of the moment cannot be overstated.
Back in 1986, I introduced the first climate change bill, and checked PolitiFacts, they said it was a game changer.
But why does climate change necessarily need to be so political? Does politics tend to minimize the seriousness of the threat as it descends into finger-pointing and posturing? As part of KCUR's coverage on climate change, I recently moderated a panel with three climate change experts. We put the question of political necessity to Vahid Rahmani. He's an assistant professor of biological and agricultural engineering at Kansas State University, and also to Richard Mabian, the president of the NAACP in Kansas City, Kansas, who's deeply involved in environmental issues, and Gloria Ortiz Fisher, the executive director of the Westside Housing Organization, which deals with climate change both politically and practically. Vahid, I'm curious, you must in your work encounter people who would deny the impact of climate change. You teach at a state school. Some political leaders at times use climate change as a political issue. I guess I'm curious, how do you discuss climate change with people who may reject that wording or the fact of it? What do you do to encourage folks to take seriously something that there are powerful voices saying you don't need to take it seriously?
I think in my case, I don't need to go even that far. I teach this subject pretty much twice a week to my students. And I have this subject as the subject of the class for almost 2 weeks of my class, so four times during each semester. And then I ask my students who believe in climate change and who does not believe in climate change, and it's usually 50-50. So what I can do on that is to just show the evidence, just to show the data. So we don't really discuss if it's happening or not. We just share the data, like what you're seeing on the screen now. And based on that, most of the time after that 2 weeks, and then after the semester that I discussed that, I have many people from one group going to the other group. Because it's not about climate change. It's just about what's happening in our backyard, based on what we are seeing, evidence.
I want to share a quote from the National Science Teaching Association. I think we have it on a slide. They're tasked with trying to explain the changes in the world to children. And so they've said, any controversies regarding climate change and human-caused contributions to climate change that are based on social, economic, or political arguments rather than scientific arguments should not be part of a science curriculum. Richard, Gloria, what was that, Richard?
Oh yeah, come on.
Oh yeah, come on. Do you see climate change as a political issue?
Yes, I'm dying to say this. When I first got involved in this movement, it was in 2008, and I had a chance to sit in on a session here in Kansas City, Missouri, with the co-founder of the Green Party. His name is John Rensenbrink. He was one of the persons got it started, and he said that he thought that the environmental movement was the first movement since the civil rights movement that actually had a chance to change policies in this country. He was very adamant about that. And then he said, but he hoped that the environmental leaders didn't make the same mistake that the civil rights leaders made and allow the movement to become a political issue. And he said that in 2008, and it's been a political issue ever since 2008. Now, when I say that, people go, yeah, but you got, especially my Sierra Club folks, yo, you got to have some politics. You got to deal with it on that level. I agree, but you can't leave out the other side.
Gloria, I mean, you there's a political aspect to your work as mm-hmm. well. You're seeking to bring groups together around issues of affordable housing. Is there space for common cause on issues relating to climate change, as far as you can see, in at least in this city's environment?
So the requirements are not there, but my organization and my board is very committed to sustainability and being climate change conscious. So we will build climate resiliency structures because that's who our organization is.
And is that across a political spectrum, your organization?
Yes. So HUD does not require climate resilient buildings. CDBG money, so that's the community block grant money from Kansas City, Missouri, or any state, does not require me. Home money from the feds does not require me to do any kind of climate resiliency, no level at all. So they would be fine if I never put a solar panel up, if I never put an energy efficient window, or as long as I got it done inside of a budget, right? So, but that's not where I'm gonna live. I'm going to make sure that anything that I'm part of in my lifetime, as far as the structures that I'm gonna build for affordable housing, that I'm pushing for every dollar, whether it's a donation or whatever, to make it climate resilient.
Here's the thing. Missouri was poised to do something about climate change 30 years ago. A bipartisan effort would have put the state on par, at that time, with California. So what happened? KCUR's Aviva Okeson-Haberman explains.
I want to be where the people are.
The Little Mermaid had just come out, Seinfeld aired its pilot episode, and in the spring of 1989, Missouri lawmakers started thinking about climate change. They created a commission to study the issue and come up with solutions.
The commission was given such a huge charge. I'd say half of our time is trying to figure out what we're supposed to do.
John Ward was among the panel's 14 experts and politicians, including eventual Governor Jay Nixon. They released a 67-page report in 1991, which covered everything from the use of solar and wind energy to transportation and teaching about climate change. Here's Ward reading from the conclusion.
Our recognition of this situation provides us the opportunity to moderate and to prepare for climate change.
They came out with more than 100 policy suggestions, like creating a statewide reforestation program, adding scholarships for college students studying sustainable agriculture, and reducing carbon dioxide emissions by 20% by 2005. But it's almost 2020, and Missouri's emissions from fossil fuel consumption have gone up by 20%, according to the U.S. Energy Information Administration.
Back in 1990, Missouri did kind of lead the way in some respects of pulling their head out of the sand and saying this is a real issue. Unfortunately, there wasn't a lot done.
Steve Moffitt was involved in writing the report and later went on to lead Missouri's Department of Natural Resources.
We're in a disappointing place. I would have hoped that we would have been much further ahead on the spectrum of addressing climate change than we are.
There's been some progress. For example, voters passed a requirement that electric utilities get 15% of their energy from renewables by 2021. But
the optimism that we kind of felt was probably somewhat misplaced. I don't know if you could do it again. I don't know if people would take it serious.
Karen Clausen is flipping through the old recommendations.
There's a lot of great things here.
She's the Air Quality and Rideshare Program Manager with the Mid-America Regional Council. It's one of the groups creating a climate action plan for Metro Kansas City.
I'm just amazed that, you know, this report from 1991, we're still dealing with some of the same issues, and the policies are so relevant in this. There's no reason we shouldn't be pulling a lot of this information out into our current planning work.
In Missouri, it's cities that are taking the lead, like Columbia passing a climate action and adaptation plan earlier this year. But it's also young people, like Kansas City climate justice activist Queen Wilkes, who want to be included in that conversation.
When I hear a lot of people talk about climate change, it's very much seen as a thing that is coming as opposed to a thing that's here. And I think that more than a lot of other generations, young people understand that.
She's a spokeswoman for Sunrise Movement KC, which advocates for political action on climate change. Wilk says during the group's training, she was asked why the climate struggle was important to her.
By not addressing this, it's a direct attack on this generation's right to dream, this generation's right to decide what they want to do with their lives as they get older.
She says the 1991 report shows that solutions exist. It's just a matter of action and urgency.
So the science is overwhelmingly clear. Climate change is here. But what exactly is climate change? That's Doug Kluck's expertise. His job with NOAA, the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration in Kansas City, is to talk to all types of people about climate change and its effects. He gave KCUR's Erica Hunzinger a primer on the basics.
People maybe think they know, but maybe they aren't totally sure. What is climate change?
The easiest thing to say is that climate change, the Earth is always going through some sort of shift or change in climate over long, long, long periods of time. It's not something we normally see within a lifetime. But what we're seeing in our lifetime is sort of a enhanced climate change. In other words, it's happening relatively quickly compared to other times in the past. The only other time we've seen climate change this abrupt is when a meteor strikes the Earth. And that's very abrupt. And that's more or less overnight and cataclysmic. This is slower than that, but yet faster than, let's say, most natural means.
Okay. And is it accelerating?
That's probably debatable. It has accelerated since the middle part of the 20th century. We see in terms of the temperatures, like in the ocean and on land, when you combine those, we've seen certainly the last 10 years, it's never been warmer in our period of record, which stretches back several hundred years.
What isn't climate change?
There are a lot of ideas of what that means. Some people think that climate change means always warming, which, again, isn't true. We're still going to have winter, even with climate change. What we've noticed, though, is that, for example, that our minimum temperatures don't get as cold as they used to. Our temperatures in the summer, you may say, oh, my goodness, it's hotter than heck, and it has been for a long time. But really, our high temperatures in the summer haven't seen, especially in Missouri and the southeast part of the U.S., haven't really seen a steep incline like the minimum temperatures.
How worried should people be about climate change?
Probably more worried than we are, pretty much, yeah. As a society, definitely worried, more worried than we are. I think it's going to take government either regulation or there's going to have to be some economic cost to move us away from the direction that we have been going and maybe are accelerating. And part of that's just our society and the way we live.
That was NOAA scientist Doug Kluck talking with KCUR's Erica Hunzinger about the basics of climate change. Fahid Rahmani from our panel conversation also offered us some climate change 101 lessons.
When I first moved to Missouri 20 years ago, they said, if you don't like the weather, just wait a minute, it'll change. The summers are hot, the winters are cold. How's the weather going to be different as climate change takes effect here?
Well, there is, I don't know how you want to touch it, but there is a lot weather changes in around the area. So first off, we have two terms, weather and climate. Weather is what we expect today or tomorrow. Climate is what we expect over a long period of time. So if you want to look at the last 30 years, last 60 years, last 100 years, that's climate. If you want to look at what we expect to have today, that's weather. So for example, today is December 3rd, right, or 4th? 3rd? 4th. So if we expected to have a temperature of 55 today, that's climate. But if it happens that we wake up this morning and we see the temperature is 25 or 95, that's weather. So now that we know what weather is so variable in Midwest, and especially in Kansas area, Missouri area. And we, as Brian was saying, we expect to see anything when we wake up the next day, because the wind and the changes that we have here, the cold fronts, the warm fronts, can cause any significant and abrupt change. So what we are seeing here, based on our research and other studies, is that we have more frequent extreme events, both in terms of too much water and too little water, so drought and flood, and also in terms of temperature, we expect to see very more frequent cold events and also more frequent warm events. One of the research that we are doing is to look at how wind, how temperature, and how relative humidity is changing in the area. And we are seeing that there will be significant change in the coming decades in the Kansas area. So our focus, the study area that we had was the entire Great Plains and some part of the Mississippi River Basin. And that's in terms of the heat waves and the high temperature. In terms of water, we have been seeing more extreme and more frequent flooding, and I think all of us have been experiencing it.
Is there a difference, Fahid, between the impact that will happen in urban areas, like right here in the heart of the Kansas City Metro, versus more rural areas or the agricultural areas you're talking about?
So climate is related to what happens on the land. Yes, in terms of if it's urban, you may have a different footprint of or impact on how climate may change because of the urban islands that we have around populated areas. So that may cause higher or greater changes in temperature as compared to a rural area. But the impact, it can be totally different. Like in urban area, because of all the structures, because of all the development, if you have even a small rain, it's gonna change, transfer to runoff or excess water on the ground. And that will cause flooding. So flooding is a huge issue, a much bigger issue in urban areas than rural areas. In rural areas, on the other hand, we have especially temperature issues, right? So if you have higher temperature, now we are in trouble to produce enough food.
When KCUR Central Standard returns after the break, how climate change may be affecting the Kansas City Metro. I'm Brian Ellison. Stay with us. Welcome back. You're listening to KCUR Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison. Today, we're hearing about climate change in Kansas City and, among other things, ways to make sure your house is prepared for the heat and the heavy rains that are sure to come to our area. Public attention on climate change seems to ebb and flow with time. There are highlights of awareness. In the 1960s, there was Rachel Carson's Silent Spring. There was the creation of Earth Day in the 1970s, and in the 90s, we learned about greenhouse gases. Of course, the early 2000s brought former Vice President Al Gore telling us an inconvenient truth. So now here at the start of the 2020s, we do hear about climate change, but we've got some distractions. There are so many things jockeying for our attention, globally, locally, even under our own roofs. So I asked Richard Mabian during our event about how to keep our society focused on climate change when so many other things demand our attention.
I mean, is there a cyclical impact? You talked about Richard being a freedom fighter
right.
In decades past.
Right. Still, I'm a freedom fighter now, too. So.
Indeed. and decades past have had sort of
right.
cycles of environmental awareness, right?
Right.
You had the Earth Day movement, mm-hmm. And then you had Al Gore talking about the environment a fair amount. Here we are, 50 years after the Earth Day movement, let's say, but we're here, and not a whole lot has changed in terms of the direction we're going, the momentum. What do we make of that? What changes that cycle of awareness followed by inaction?
We have made some tremendous strides, and I will give credit for that from 2006, but they've been made in silos. And what has happened is your academic community, they have made some tremendous discoveries and strides and knowledge and graphs and can sit up and just tickle you to death with everything they know. But then when you come into the other parts of society, we're not working together, I find it very difficult to bridge that gap that exists between what I'm doing with boots on the ground and what's going on in our academic communities. There's a total separation. And even in your areas, like with the housing, I mean, the housing, affordable housing, is such a horrendous problem right now. But yet and still, the other areas of the environmental world aren't talking with people in affordable housing. They own their own. So you're having to try to figure out how you're going to keep the water from coming in your basement, or how you're going to keep the moisture from coming in your home, because you don't have people that are down there that have that knowledge that's involved with a little meter that you can put on your wall that can tell you what kind of problems you got in your house. So when we're able to bring this together as a society and start working with each other, that'll be the way that we'll start making progress, and people will start seeing something going on and want to be a part of it.
The Kansas City area does have a vast diversity of housing options, considering the dense urban areas, sprawling suburbs, and rural communities. As Richard Mabian just suggested, that's a challenge for policymakers and planners who have to respond to the potential risk of climate change. KCUR's Laura Ziegler looked at how it might affect the most vulnerable, talking in more depth with one of our panelists.
Gloria Ortiz Fisher is the director of Westside Housing, and she is attached to this community west of downtown Kansas City, where her grandfather once brought his 12 kids from Mexico.
This neighborhood has a lot of meaning for me, and I actually would go to that church with my grandparents.
Around the corner from Our Lady of Guadalupe Church are some small brick apartments. Fisher explains that the 100-year-old buildings sit on solid foundations, but the roofs and the windows are showing signs of decay. The forecast that climate change will bring extended periods of heavy rainfall are a hazard.
So a window that has a minor crack becomes a flood in your home or a leak in your home, and now you're talking about mold mitigation or something like that. It's like a tumbling weed, right? It just gets bigger and bigger.
And so do the repair bills on these subsidized rentals. Urban apartments are also vulnerable to something climatologists call the urban heat island, where close together buildings and pavement absorb and radiate heat, and where there's often a lack of tree cover. Temperatures in these areas can be 5 to 10 degrees higher than in outlying areas, which strains air conditioners.
We're going to get calls all day long about this unit's out, that unit's out.
And excessive use of AC, of course, spikes utility bills. Kansas City is one of the top metro areas in the country where a disproportionate amount of household income is spent on energy, and residents in Missouri have seen their utility bills rise by more than 10% since 2001. It's a problem, says Gary Schechter, sustainability coordinator for Kansas City, Missouri's Office of Environmental Quality.
And that's where the oldest, most dilapidated housing is, with people who are least able to address the issue by making repairs or energy efficiency improvements, let alone renewable energy.
The vulnerability to climate change extends to those living outside of our big cities. Steve Thibodeau has been a home builder for 20 years in Belton, Missouri, where manufactured homes and trailers have provided hundreds of low-income and military housing for decades. Experts say mobile homes and trailers are among the most at risk during severe weather. And while the industry has taken measures to stabilize these structures, Thibodeau drives me through a couple of older parks and suggests these residents are still very much at risk.
The skirting around the base can be blown off, which allows wind to get underneath it and lift it.
Thibodeau says to minimize risk, the homes need to be well anchored at the bottom with something that reaches side to side over the roof. But if we see more and heavier storms, he says these mitigations will be no match for heavy rainfall and falling trees.
I just say pay attention to your city's emergency sirens. I mean, don't think you're going to sit in your tub and ride it out, because that tub is going to go in the air.
There's a new coalition of elected officials, nonprofits, and utilities looking to address climate change and the disparate needs of our sprawling area, including housing. Roland Park Mayor Mike Kelly co-founded the group called the Metro KC Climate Action Coalition.
We have a wide range of housing, whether it be very urban to very rural. We know that one size doesn't necessarily fit all, but climate resilient housing is empowerment.
Kelly says the important thing to remember is that climate knows no boundaries. So ultimately, we're all vulnerable, no matter where we live.
That was KCUR's Laura Ziegler. Missouri and Kansas saw near-record precipitation in 2019. It was the second wettest year in the U.S. recorded history. exposing the vulnerability of people who live near the Missouri River and its tributaries. All that water, you see, has to go somewhere. It puts pressure on the area's levees and, of course, the 100-year-old sewers. Kansas City's in the expensive process of fixing those, and KCUR's Lisa Rodriguez found that rain-friendly green spaces could make the system more resilient.
Kansas City stormwater engineer Tom Kimes looks out at the Kansas River. Because of all the snow and rain in the past year, reservoirs are at record levels, which means the Army Corps of Engineers will start releasing water from those reservoirs upstream. That's the kind of flooding you can prepare for.
So we advise the Emergency Operations Center for Kansas City, coordinate with other communities in the area.
The other kind of flooding, flash flooding, is harder to plan for. Doug Kluck is a climate scientist for the National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration.
The frequency of heavy rainfall events has increased since the 1950s, for sure.
And he says cities are beginning to realize that their infrastructure isn't prepared to deal with it.
It hasn't been in Kansas City for a long time, thus we're paying, you know, X for water bills.
What he's referring to is the wastewater section of your bill. In 2010, the Environmental Protection Agency ordered Kansas City to make extensive improvements to its sewer systems. Here's why.
In Kansas City, we have two types of sewage systems. We have separate sewer systems and combined sewer systems.
Lisa Treese is a landscape architect at KC Water. If you live in a part of town built before 1950, which is pretty much the Missouri River down to 85th Street and state line to 435, you probably have a combined sewer system. That means the stormwater from rain and everything you flush from your home all flow through the same pipe. It works if you don't get a lot of rain.
But when you get a heavy rain and it flows across lots of surfaces that can't soak in water, like parking lots and roads and roofs, that quickly fills up that pipe that's supposed to carry the sewage and the stormwater.
All that combined sewage builds up pressure in the pipes, and it has to release somewhere, ideally not your basement or the streets.
So basically what ends up happening is you have relief points where the stormwater mixed with the sewage goes into the creek, stream, or river.
The fix will cost $4.5 billion over 25 years, and you're paying for it. It would be way too expensive to dig up and replace every combined sewer pipe in the city, so engineers have put in some green projects to alleviate the pressure on the pipes. You can see some of that work in Kansas City's Marlboro neighborhood. It's one of several areas where that gross, untreated water flows into the Blue River. Diane Hirschberger with the Marlboro Community Coalition says this lot at 81st and Troost used to be a problem for the neighborhood.
It was all overgrown with honeysuckle and shrub, and along the street was a really disgusting commercial space.
Now, when it rains, the water's collected in a pond at the center of a green park instead of shooting straight into the sewers. Wild native vegetation planted across the 11-acre site will create a spongy soil that holds stormwater and cleans it before it flows back into the river. And construction is underway on a little amphitheater on one corner of the site and a playground on the other.
I just noticed for the first time you can see the tube for the slide, so it'll be a really great asset.
Hirschberger says they're incorporating more green projects like this into their neighborhood revitalization plan. But not everything has been perfect. Maintenance of some of the green spaces falls to residents who never asked for them. And building the site at 81st and Troost was a nightmare for nearby residents like Alvina Krusinski.
Every day it was get up, pick up and clean up the things that had fallen, because that was a lot of work they did.
Even through all that, Krusinski says she's glad it's there. If money were no object, Lisa Treese, the green space architect, would love to replicate it across the city.
So we do have a lot of opportunities to implement green infrastructure in Kansas City that could really help us be more resilient down the line.
The issue is finding the money. With a strapped city budget and already high water bills, more green solutions like these are still on the wish list.
That's KCUR's Lisa Rodriguez. Her report focused on urban areas, and the urban-rural divide really plays into the effects of climate change, as Vahid Rahmani mentioned earlier in the show. Kansas and Missouri raise a lot of cattle, providing meat for the United States and for a major part of Kansas City's identity, barbecue. Meat also factors into another major part of life for the Kansas City Black community, cookouts. We all gotta eat. But KCUR's Michelle Tyrene Johnson wanted to see whether cutting back on meat would impact communal meals.
In the Black community, summer cookouts with music and family and friends, beef and pork on the grill is a cultural staple. But cutting back on meat is one of the ways experts say that we can all help with climate change. Gigi Jones, also known as Gigi the Vegan, says that for the Black community, all the plant-based meat substitutions out there should make the transition easier. Jones, who's Black, counsels people on how to eat better to live better. She likes to teach people that the meat might change, but the flavor and the tradition doesn't have to.
I can still have my food the same way. I can still have my burgers. I can still have my fries. We can still grill out and cook out and have fun and chit-chat it up and show each other love. Oh, yeah, put that Frank and Beverly back on. Let's get it.
While she primarily focuses on health, Jones knows that it's good for the planet, too. She also knows that convincing her fellow Black people to pay more attention to climate change issues requires telling people they can just cut back. They don't have to completely cut out hamburgers, hot dogs, and ribs.
I'm not one of those radical vegans. I'm really not. It's my own personal journey, but I do try to help people to get to understand the impact that it has on our environment.
Jones was diagnosed with colon cancer in 2015. She attributes her decision to go vegan to being a great part of why she is a cancer-free diagnosis today. She says one of the ways to appeal to more Black people is using more inclusive messaging, which is why she called her first vegan festival the Soul Veg Fest. She says about 2,000 people attended.
And the language has to be there for us to say, oh, this is for us. Oh, they're talking about us. Oh, and so when I use social media, when I use certain tools now, I make sure that that language is not racially biased.
Livestock emissions likely play a role in climate change, and Timothy Searchinger, a professor and researcher at Princeton University, says while it's complicated, the bottom line is that the world is warming faster than it should.
And what's causing it to warm is the increase of greenhouse gas.
He says part of the connection between meat consumption and climate change boils down to the use of land.
Beef is the most land-hungry form of food.
According to the Department of Agriculture, the average American eats more than 220 pounds of meat a year. Searchinger says that compared to the rest of the world, wealthy includes America's poor when it comes to meat consumption.
I mean, if everybody in the world ate as much beef as the average American, we basically need another planet.
Nicole Jackson from Olathe attended Soul Veg Fest because she's trying to make the turn to vegan. It's about health and it's about helping the environment. Jackson says that opening the door to a different way of eating can sometimes just be as simple as exposure. For example, some Black folks may not know much about a kale salad when they're used to cooked collard and turnip greens.
A lot of times these things happen because we don't have the experience with other foods. We're very restricted to what we're open to.
Jackson says climate change should be more of a concern to everyone than it is now.
Letting go of tradition are pretty much held in place by dead people.
Cookouts with family and loved ones are part of Black community tradition. And there are some concerned about the environment who want to make sure that future generations of Black friends and family, along with the rest of the world, can enjoy.
That was KCUR's Michelle Tyrene Johnson. After the break, we'll talk about practical ways to mitigate climate change. So stick around. I'm Brian Ellison. You're listening to KCUR's Central Standard. Welcome back to Central Standard. I'm Brian Ellison, and we're talking today about climate change in Kansas City. It's time to focus on maybe the most important part, what you and I personally can do about it. A recent survey showed that 2/3 of U.S. households are concerned about their carbon footprint, that is, how much their lifestyle is contributing to the carbon dioxide levels in our atmosphere, carbon dioxide that helps trap heat and drives up the Earth's temperature. Some homeowners in the Kansas City area are trying to lessen their impact by going solar. But as KCUR's Kyle Palmer tells us, not everyone can afford that switch.
Installing a home solar system big enough to power even an average household's energy needs isn't cheap.
I believe the number is just under $17,000.
That's what Angelina Lyden is paying for her new rooftop system on her home in the Northland. She's an accountant, and she's crunched the numbers. Her monthly energy bills can top $250. With solar panels, she expects to pay closer to zero. So, she says, that steep out-of-pocket cost is worth it in the long run.
I mean, it saves you money. It saves people energy in general. It just seems like the smart way to go.
Lyden has some savings to pay for it, and she's also getting some help from an uncle who is a solar enthusiast. But for most middle-income homeowners, cost is the first and often biggest barrier to going solar. Just ask Jordan Starkey.
If you want an example like a car, it's sticker shock.
He's president of Lifetime Solar, a Kansas City-based installer. Industry groups say the price of solar panels has dropped 70% over the past decade. And Starkey says homeowners can now easily finance a home solar system.
Banks of credit unions have been getting behind this, providing reasonable financing to customers that has allowed them to kind of bridge that gap.
That means solar panels could be paying for themselves within 10 years, add in tax credits and rebates, and going solar starts to make economic sense. At least that's the argument, even from environmental advocates like James Owen.
Forget about the altruism of the environment. Forget about clean energy. What's this doing to the bottom line for the value of your property, and what's this doing to the bottom line of your monthly budget?
Owen is with Renew Missouri, a group that advocates for broader access to renewable energy. Across state line in Kansas, there are also limitations on home solar, but for a very different reason.
We're lucky enough to be close to really cheap, affordable wind.
Drew Robinson is manager of renewables for Evergy, Kansas's largest utility. The company has focused on developing the state's abundant wind resources. Wind power now makes up nearly 30% of Evergy's overall generating capacity. Solar, on the other hand, less than 1%.
But I do think in the coming years, I think solar will continue to gain steam.
But solar advocates complain Evergy has stifled the growth of residential panels in a big way. In Kansas, the utility charges solar customers an extra monthly fee, which can dramatically increase bills and wipe out any savings solar customers expect. Dorothy Barnett with the nonprofit Climate and Energy Project helped negotiate an end to that fee for established solar customers. But anyone thinking of installing a home solar system in Kansas now will get hit with it.
They're reluctant to take the leap in the first place.
Evergy does allow customers without home solar panels to offset their home's energy by subscribing to energy produced by the utility's solar arrays. It's an acknowledgement that many residents want their homes powered by solar, even if they can't afford it.
KCUR's Kyle Palmer reporting there. Of course, you don't have to empty your bank account and install enormous solar panels on your house to make a difference. There are practical, simpler, smaller ways to reduce your footprint. KCUR's Andrea Tudhope talked with Karen Clausen from the Mid-America Regional Council, who had a few suggestions.
Plastic bottles, aluminum foil, glass containers, and motor oil.
I feel like we've been talking about the three R's for decades, you know,
sure.
as far back as I can remember. Is that still useful for us to be thinking about?
Yeah, I think so. And I think there's a lot of emphasis right now on reducing our consumption, reducing the resources that we're drawing from, and then reusing as much as possible. Recycling is still important to do, but there's been, you know, some challenges in the last few years about, you know, what actually is happening to our recyclables. Are they actually getting recycled? And so really focusing on not using single-use plastics.
Okay, I want to talk about what we eat.
Most of the time, for Kansas City, our food is traveling from California or South America or other parts of the world, and there's a carbon footprint associated with that, of course. One of the great things about living in Kansas City is that we're surrounded by a lot of great farmers and farmland and people who are excited about urban agriculture, so you can get food grown locally really easily here. We also have a lot of great resources if you want to try producing some of your own tomatoes or green beans or squash.
How we get around is also big. What changes can people make to their transportation habits?
The biggest things that you're looking for is how do you reduce the amount of driving that you do? So maybe one day a week, if your employer allows you to, maybe working at home. If you can't use a different form of transportation that's better for the environment, like biking walking, riding the bus. There's something called eco driving.
What is that?
It's just about the way you drive your car. So everything that you do in your car pulls energy and uses more gas. So the radio and your heater and your air conditioning and when you're using it, maybe trying to use it a little bit less.
What about energy usage for households?
We all know, you know, turn your lights off when you're not in the house. There are Energy Star appliances all over the place that you can buy. And there's, I believe, some federal incentives tied to those.
Evergy in, here in Kansas City also offers incentives. Can you talk about those?
One of the great programs that they have right now is the Energy Savings Kit. And what happens is they send out a professional who will do almost like an energy audit on your home and give you some great tips, things that you can do specific to your home that will help you with saving energy.
So I wonder if people ever had this sense of like, if I start a compost, if I recycle, if I'm reducing my food waste, maybe it makes me feel better. But how do I know that what I'm doing is making a difference?
It is making a difference. I think it's really easy to get bogged down in the doom and gloom of climate change. We can still make a big impact here. It will take an army to do this. Individuals, nonprofits, businesses, elected officials, everybody has a place.
Like Karen Clausen told KCUR's Andrea Tudhope there, changing the course of climate change won't be done solely with keeping your house at 65 degrees and using candles instead of overhead lights. After all, you're just one person. So I asked the panel,
Vahid, who should be coming up with solutions? In fact, let me ask all of you that question. How should we be Who should be doing the thinking about the ways to mitigate the effects of climate change?
So what, that's a very good question, especially for this area. So what's happening, at least in Kansas, since I teach at K-State, is that whatever we are trying to do in the state, in most agencies, from the Kansas Department of Health, Health and Environment, or Kansas Water Office, or the Department of Agriculture, the main people that we always go to is the stakeholders. Who are the stakeholders? Us, right? Whoever is using that water, if the issue is water, or if the issue is climate, who is living here? It's us, people. So when you ask who should be at the table, to me, it's everyone, and Kansas is one of the best states in the country doing that job. That has came from the Congress, that Kansas is, so think it was 2 or 3 years ago that we, KDHE, Kansas Department of Health and Environment, put together a plan to manage the water for one of the big reservoirs, Tuttle Creek, if anyone is familiar with. And that was the best plan selected in the nation. Why? Because everyone was on the table when we were talking about who should take care of this issue. And I think by that, you will get the feedback from the people who are experiencing it. Because I, as a scientist, I may have access to lots of data, and I may see it from a totally different angle that someone who is living it, who is experiencing it, would see it. So when we suggest different management types, there are many cases that people who are experiencing the issues will go back to us and say, hey, yes, you're right, but that's not going to work in our area. We already tried it. So everyone.
Everyone has to do something. Not everyone may feel like they're equally in a position to do something. Not everyone has the luxury of buying their way out of rising temperatures. So Gloria, what words of hope or encouragement do you offer to folks who feel like, as you said earlier, I'm living paycheck to paycheck. Asking me to take action on climate change seems like a lot to ask.
So I think it's a lot of what Richard said, where education on what they can do. So we did the same thing with the LED light bulbs, and I had people moving out of my apartments, and guess what they took? The LED light bulb.
Yeah,
the $7 light bulb. Right. Yeah, and part of me just goes, ugh. But the other side is, you know, they learned something, right? And so if I have to go get more donations, I go get more donations. But yeah, so I think any part of the family can learn. I see myself as someone who can teach by just what we're doing in the buildings.
Richard. Oh, you should be ready for this. I had a problem with the water problem in Flint. And so I got with some environmental organizations, namely one is Friends of the Call, and we created a program where we're going into the public schools in Kansas City, Kansas. They're teaching the young people how to scientifically test water, and they have it in four different stages. And each one of those stages, they have a person there that teaches them how to take water from when it comes into an intake center, like coming out of the river, being analyzed and determined what's in the water, being figuring out what they're going to have to do to clean the water. Then they get to a point on the other end where they actually start using chemicals to go into the water, shake it up, and they have them going from that dirty water that you have to the clean water that you have. Now, they put that together. They got some scientists that are in there working on those stations, but they got one non-scientist station, and yours truly has that station. And what I'm doing is explaining to them exactly why they need to know this. Now they need to know it because they can prevent their family from going through what went on up in Flint. You don't need the government to tell you this water's bad. Once you learn this process, EPA has no problem of giving you the kit you need and having you go down there and you can test your own daggum water. And what it's doing is giving them such a ego about what they're able to do. You can see it in the young people's face, man. They just so excited about having a chance. Some of them go, I never thought I would like science, but I love this.
As you heard Richard Mabian discuss there, the climate change puzzle cannot be solved without an entire generation of young, extremely motivated people. KCUR's Ellie Moxley spent time with a group of middle schoolers who are trying to change their future.
It is a busy afternoon at Chisholm Trail Middle School in Olathe. It's the last day of school before a three-day weekend. There's a football game, and the Future Cities team keeps getting interrupted by announcements.
All right, students.
No, but eighth grader Mary Glasgow has a point to make.
Okay, so basically, the reason why I keep pulling it up is because it leaves more water for the citizens because vertical...
It's Mary's third year competing in Future Cities, a middle school science competition that has students engineering solutions to problems cities will face 100 years from now.
Last year was building, you know, a reliable power grid that can withstand natural disasters, and I knew absolutely nothing about it. And so all the research that went into it, I mean, I find it really interesting to, like, learn new topics and just, you know, expand my horizon.
This year's topic is clean water, except students don't have to imagine a future where nothing happens when you turn on the tap because it's already a reality in cities in California and across the Southwest. Eighth grader Liam McKinley tries to keep up with the latest on climate change.
Whenever I hear something about the environment and clean energy, I always try to listen in, even when my parents are talking to me.
Liam knows all about Greta Thunberg, the Swedish teenager who scolded the United Nations for not taking climate change seriously.
I like to see kids taking action of what might happen in the future. I like to come up with random ideas about how we can fix that, even though it may not be like achievable in the next few years.
Chisholm Trail gifted teacher Dion Hobson has been coaching Future Cities teams for 10 years.
And then there are some kids, especially the particularly bright ones, who are able to see, you know, hey, that's something that could impact me and I need to pay attention to that.
The Future Cities competition asks tough questions about how we'll live when most of Earth's natural resources have been depleted. Already, Liam and his classmates have some good ideas.
Try not to poke holes, but I might see a little bit of a flaw with that. The water pressure might not be.
Quite a few kids who really are paying attention and could have a pretty, pretty adult conversation about a lot of the issues that are going on in the world. We get into politics sometimes, which is a fine line.
This isn't just a middle school science competition, it's the future these kids will inherit.
That was KCUR's Ellie Moxley. And her reporting, in fact, all the reporting you've heard today, has us thinking about the kind of future we're going to inherit. Could be that this decade will set another record as the hottest in recorded history. So maybe climate change will become the hot topic, no pun intended, not just this year, but every year. We hope this hour's been a chance to think critically about our habits, our priorities, and the health of our planet, and what we might do as a result. You can listen back to this special at kcur.org/centralstandard later this afternoon. On Monday, we'll be talking win or lose about the Kansas City Chiefs and Super Bowl 54, and we'll want to hear from you. Thanks to the KCUR Newsroom for its reporting, to event coordinators Chris Young and Mike Russo for their work on the panel discussion, and to editor Erica Hunzinger, who oversaw this entire reporting project. Central Standard is produced by Melody Rowell, Mackenzie Martin, and Noah Taborda. Sylvia Maria Gross is our senior producer. You can talk to us on Twitter anytime. We are at KCURCST, and I'm at PTS Brian. Gina Kaufman's back on Monday. I'm Brian Ellison. Up to Date is next.